This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
There are an awful lot of questions, inconsistencies, gaps, and that's why, to be fair to both, we need to know what happened.
That's Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins yesterday on all the questions surrounding the sexual assault allegations made against Supreme Court nominee Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Both Kavanaugh and his accuser, Professor Christine Blasey Ford, will testify publicly on Monday. That delays the Judiciary Committee's vote that had been scheduled for this week, frustrating President Donald Trump.
This is something that should have been brought up long before this. They had the information in July, as I understand it. That's a long time ago, and nobody mentioned it until the other day.
This hour On Point, sexual assault allegations and the future of the Supreme Court. You can join us. What do you think about the allegations against Judge Brett Kavanaugh? Do you hear echoes of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings from 27 years ago? How much has changed or hasn't with how the nation and how national leaders deal with allegations of sexual assault? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me first from Washington today is Tara Golshan. She's congressional reporter for Vox. We have a link to her latest story. It's called Where Brett Kavanaugh's Senate Confirmation Process Stands. The link is at our website, onpointradio.org. Tara, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I mean, bring us up to speed. What are you hearing in terms of reaction from members of Congress that indeed we will have public testimony from Kavanaugh and Blasey on Monday?
I mean, I think definitely that was kind of the consensus that was reached yesterday. Both Democrats and Republicans said that this was something that they wanted to happen. But the big question remains is how this investigation is going to go forward. You still have Democrats saying that this is not an investigation that should be conducted by Congress, that it should be something the FBI conducts. They're not asking for a criminal investigation. They're asking to reopen the background check, which the FBI typically conducts on Supreme Court nominations. They're saying that Republicans can't be impartial in this kind of proceeding. And Republicans are, I mean, still attacking Democrats for, quote-unquote, withholding information that they've had for months. Obviously, there are some questions about the accuser here who asked for confidentiality that's being kind of not addressed by that attack directed at Democrats. And there are a lot of questions on the individual member level of, well, what would need to have, what will need to be said for them to find these accusations credible?
Right.
And if so, whether or not they will actually even take them into account. Yesterday,
yeah.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah said, well, even if these accusations are credible, we have to look at who Brett Kavanaugh is today.
Well, in fact, Tara, sorry to jump in there, but we have a little clip from Senator Hatch again yesterday. This is from CNN, and he was recounting a conversation he had just yesterday morning with Brett Kavanaugh about the allegations.
Yeah, I'd say he's upset. Mm-hmm. But he handled it well. And he's a very strong, decent man.
And you believe him?
Yeah, I sure do.
Uh-huh. Do you believe the accusers at all?
Well, I think she's mistaken. I think she's mistaken something, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know her.
At the end there, Senator Orrin Hatch saying, I don't know her. I think she's mistaken. I don't know her. Tara Golshan, I mean, think this gets right to what you were saying, that there's a fundamental question that the senators have to face about who they believe and what the consequences of that decision will be. And you heard Senator Orrin Hatch saying, well, I know Judge Kavanaugh and I believe him. I don't know Professor Blasey, so I think she's mistaken.
Yeah, that's something I heard. I was talking to Senator Bob Corker yesterday of Tennessee, and that's exactly what he said to me as well. He said, well, we know him. We've known him for a very long time. We don't know her. We have to hear from her. But I mean, there is definitely some framing going on going into this hearing Monday.
So can we actually just take a step back, Tara, because, you know, so much has happened in the past 48 hours. I just want to lay down some facts as we know them, because you mentioned that there is some political push-pull over the existence of the allegation and the timeline on which it was made public, and the timeline on which Professor Blasey identified herself. I mean, as far as I understand, when she had first contacted the Washington Post, and then California congressional member, and then Senator Dianne Feinstein, she had consistently requested that her identity remain anonymous.
Yeah, so what we know is that she had requested confidentiality, and that is in part of why Democrats say that they did not, or Dianne Feinstein says that she did not go forward to the committee and dealt with this anonymously and confidentially.
I see. But then the contents of the letter that she had written to Senator Feinstein was leaked to the press?
Right. So there was an initial report about the letter in The Intercept, and then a subsequent report in BuzzFeed. And eventually Senator Feinstein acknowledged that she did pass on a letter to the FBI. And then we started seeing the contents of that letter drip out over the last weekend. And finally, when the story was essentially out there, but without her name, she said that that was the time she felt like she had to come forward and attach her name to it because it was her story.
I see. Okay. So then looking forward to Monday then, the hearing is set to begin sometime Monday morning. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
Okay. It does seem as if, I mean, I'm just seeing here that Anita Hill has written an op-ed in the New York Times today saying that the Senate needs to get, or the Judiciary Committee needs to make some significant changes in order to get this set of hearings right. And, you know, she wants an impartial third party to do the investigation of the allegations. I mean, talk to me a little bit about the fact that it was 27 years ago that the Hill-Thomas hearings happened, and it's casting a long shadow right now.
Right. And that's something that I was hearing from Democratic aides this morning, that so the Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley went on Hugh Hewitt this morning, and he said that there would just be the two witnesses, so Kavanaugh and Dr. Ford. And that is a break from even what happened in Anita Hill's hearings. Obviously, she had multiple witnesses that testified to her account. Clarence Thomas had as well. And so there are a lot of questions being raised of what kind of investigation should be done, and how impartial can this panel of senators be. As we speak this morning in the Senate, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell are expected to lay out what they would like to see in the investigations.
Yeah. Well, Tara Golshan is a congressional reporter at Vox, joining us today from Washington. Tara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, let's move on and get a couple of other views here on this really complex and interesting moment we are once again in as a country. Joining us now from New York is Erin Carmone. She's senior correspondent at New York Magazine. We have a link to her story. It's titled, "Will Brett Kavanaugh Face Any Consequences? Women Will." That link is at onpointradio.org. Erin Carmone, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us today. Also with us from Washington, Mona Charon joins us. She's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, syndicated columnist at the National Review, and author of Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. Her latest story is Kavanaugh in the Me Too Era, and we've got a link to that again at onpointradio.org. Mona Charon, welcome to you.
Thanks, Meghna. Glad to be here.
I'm really glad to have you both, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking with the two of you. So let me just get your first reaction here. I mean, Erin Carmone, we're going to have testimony, public testimony under oath from Judge Kavanaugh and Professor Blasey on Monday. How significant do you think it is?
Well, I mean, I think it's a testament to the fact that for the past year, so many people have raised their hands and said, me too. I've reported some of these stories, and I've seen firsthand how challenging it is, both for people who have stories, to tell those stories and to put their names on them, and also to take those through the rigorous process. And the stories that I published about Charlie Rose and CBS were at the Washington Post, the same place that Dr. Ford chose to tell her story. This is not a fun process. So that's the backdrop. Now, looking ahead next week, we are looking at hearings in which hostile politicians are going to question each side of this. And, you know, as Tara was talking before, I think there are significant questions about what this hearing is going to look like. Is this a pro forma hearing if they're not calling as a witness the third person that Dr. Ford says was in the room, Mark Judge? Whether he can speak to, whether he remembers anything that happened and so on. How real of an inquiry is this if you aren't even going to call all of these witnesses? But more broadly speaking, I think this, if this hearing does happen next week, and I think that there are still open questions as to whether it will, it's an enormously perilous moment for everybody because this isn't just political posturing. There are millions of women in this country who have experienced exactly what Dr. Ford said happened to her. They have been held down. They have had hands clapped over their mouths. They have not told anyone. And so this is going to bring back a lot of really difficult memories for survivors across the country.
Mona Sharon, your first thoughts?
Well, it's really a problem, it seems to me, if this particular story is framed as if you are pro-woman and if you have either experienced sexual abuse yourself or are sympathetic with women who have, that you have to believe this particular woman and that this sort of is a test of your sensitivity. Because the fact is, as we have seen, and I am very well disposed toward the Me Too movement. I think it's long overdue and terrific. But I think we have to also remember that a man's entire life and reputation is on the line here. And he may very well be innocent of this accusation. And when we look at the people who have been brought down by Me Too accusations, there is always a pattern. Mm-hmm. Men who are abusers of women tend to be abusers throughout their whole lives. There's always more than one person to come forward and say, yes, he did these things. And that's very, very dispositive when you see more than one accuser. And I remember when Bill Cosby was first accused, and then a second woman came forward, and I thought, that's it.
Right.
You know, it's very, very important to see a pattern of behavior before you draw a conclusion about someone.
Yeah. Well, we're speaking with Mona Charon and Erin Carmone about the fact that Judge Brett Kavanaugh and Professor Christine Blasey Ford have both said that they are willing to testify on Monday publicly under oath about the allegations that she's brought against him. The Supreme Court and the Me Too moment want to hear from you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. We tell engaging, one-of-a-kind stories that give you a more nuanced sense of Latin America and the U.S. Latino community today. From events that are changing the political landscape to intimate stories about everyday people. Listen to Radio Ambulante on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today about Judge Brett Kavanaugh and Professor Christine Blasey Ford. And the fact that they have said they will be willing to testify on Monday publicly and under oath about the accusations that she's brought against him as he seeks confirmation to the United States Supreme Court. I'm speaking today with Mona Charon. She's senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a syndicated columnist at the National Review. Also with us is Erin Carmone. She's a senior correspondent at New York Magazine. And let's hear what President Donald Trump has had to say about this. He was asked about the allegations of sexual assault against Kavanaugh. The president was speaking yesterday in the Oval Office, and here he is defending Kavanaugh's character.
Judge Kavanaugh is one of the finest people that I've ever known. He's an outstanding intellect, an outstanding judge, respected by everybody, never had even a little blemish on his record.
And here is Deborah Katz, Christine Blasey Ford's lawyer. She had a response on today's on the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie when asked if her client thinks that Brett Kavanaugh should withdraw his Supreme Court nomination.
She's not taking a position on that. She believes that these allegations obviously bear on his character and his fitness. And the denials, of course, also bear on his character and fitness.
Mona Charon, I just want to turn back to you briefly because there's something that you said before we had to take a break that I want to follow up on. I mean, you said that this is obviously a very serious moment because Judge Kavanaugh's reputation is on the line. Can't the same be said for Professor Blasey as well? I mean, her reputation is absolutely on the line, and arguably she has far less of a robust infrastructure of political support around her. I mean, I'm seeing that for a long time she did not want to go public because she didn't want to risk, quote, the annihilation of herself and her character if she did so.
Right. So here we have a situation where there are diametrically opposed positions being taken by two individuals, both of whom have a lot to lose if they are disbelieved. And it's awful. But we are looking at it from the outside, and we cannot come into it. And this is what's so distressing, is that, you know, what this calls for is sort of good faith, fair-mindedness, impartiality on the side of all of us who are being called upon to make judgments here, just the kind of traits, by the way, that you want in a good judge. And yet it will be tried in the public. It will be tried with people who have already come to it with their minds made up because they either don't like Republicans or they don't like they don't like this judge, or they do Democrats and they and so on. And so it's really hard to see how this particular process is going to get us to the truth. I'm afraid that what we're going to see is just people going to their corners and not being fair or impartial and taking the facts into account.
Right. So, Erin Carmon, I mean, pick up on that. It does seem as if the red-hot glare of being in the public eye and makes the Senate Judiciary Committee and the politics surrounding this makes the Senate Judiciary Committee possibly one of the worst places to try and discern the truth of something that may have happened more than 30 years ago.
I mean, I agree with Mona that people should not retreat to their corners. And if so, hearing from Republican senators who are on the Senate Judiciary Committee that no matter what, they already think that Brett Kavanaugh is telling the truth, it does not inspire confidence in the process. And if that is the case, why not let a neutral investigative body like the FBI take this into account, interview more witnesses? Why only call two witnesses? Why not call the third person in a room? Again, Dr. Ford said that another person, Professor Blasey, said that there's another person in the room. Republicans have said they will not call that person. So I think that there are serious questions about the integrity of this process and whether, if it does move forward, it's just a way to kind of push forward.
Yeah.
And I want to say something before the break. Mona mentioned that there's always a pattern. It has been the case in my reporting that there is often a pattern. But I also think we have to evaluate the fact that this is taking place in the context of a really heated partisan battle. Republicans have opened the window of inquiry a tiny crack. It's 7 days. Imagine being a person who is considering coming forward in this environment, knowing that everything that you do is going to be torn apart, knowing that your life is going to be put on trial. No wonder Dr. Ford wasn't totally sure she wanted to do it. And I think each allegation has to be investigated on its own merits, whether there are 10 accusers, whether there are 35. Each one has to be evaluated. And it's not being evaluated by the standard of a criminal trial. This is a man who is up for a lifetime appointment to make life or death decisions for the United States for the rest of his life. And it's a job interview. And so I think if it speaks to his character, each allegation has to be fairly investigated. And so far, I think there are major, major concerns about whether this is a fair process.
Yeah. So, Mona, go ahead, Mona.
Yeah. So let me respond to that. You know, also we have to take into account when you're looking at a man's entire life, look at his career. I mean, it's not surprising that people are saying that they're inclined to believe him because he has had a spotless life, so far as we know. Now, if this accusation turns out to be true, And I kind of agree that we would need more evidence than other than just the two people's accounts. But if it turns out to be true, then his entire life is a lie. But it could be untrue. And then you have a person who has lived a spotless life, who has given to charity, who has done minority outreach for law students, who, you know, coaches girls basketball, who's been, by all accounts, an exemplary boss who has hired more women than any other judge on the D.C. Circuit as clerks and so on and so forth. And everyone testifies to his sterling reputation. And that has to count for something as well.
Yeah. Well, Mona, can I just follow up with you on one thing? Because I'm thinking that if the Me Too moment has taught us anything, and you know, people can debate on what those lessons might be, but I think one of them is that until women came forward with credible allegations against any of the number of men that we've seen be accused in the past couple of years, you could say the same thing about those men, that until that moment, they all had spotless records. They were all
exemplars. I don't agree.
Exemplars.
I don't agree. No, there were rumors. There were stories. People had winks and nods. It was, you should never get yourself alone in his office. I mean, that's one of the reasons, you know, when they started circulating that list of, I'm not going to say it on the radio, but bad men
right.
on the internet, right? That was because it was common knowledge who the abusers were and who the guys were who were behaving this way. So I don't agree that it's just, you know, it's the most wonderful people and then you find out that they're actually living a lie. No, I don't think that's the case.
I think we could also, frankly, we could learn from the Catholic priest molestation scandals that people are not always who they appear. Many of those people were known to be pillars in their community. Certainly, there are many kinds of people who commit abuse. And I also find...
But to be fair, in the case of the Catholic Church, there was the entire structure of the church and the archdiocese in many places in the country and around the world that were actively protecting these priests.
Yes,
nobody's suggesting that about Kavanaugh.
No, but there are a lot of people whose vested interest it is to see him confirmed. There is a 40-year conservative movement trying to get control of the Supreme Court. There are a lot of – listen, I think that the fact that people testify to his character matters, but it's not the end of the inquiry. And I think that if we set up that every person who may have committed a crime or may have done something to hurt somebody else, that they have to be a Harvey Weinstein-level monster, you're going to leave out a lot of stories.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a tremendous range here. And I think sorry, go ahead.
But I would love to ask you, Erin, if there's any case that you reported on where there was a single accusation and nobody else came forward and said, yes, the same thing happened to me with this particular person.
I can say that for the two long investigative pieces I did at the Washington Post, there were always people who said, no, he's a wonderful guy.
Mona,
if I may, I'll let Erin answer the question, but I'm just curious, isn't the obvious my obvious response to you, Mona, is we don't yet know who else might come forward.
No. And I agree that would be dispositive for me. I mean, if somebody else were to step forward now, having been emboldened by Professor Ford, that would be dispositive. But if no one else does, it's a much tougher case.
I'm reminded of what Catherine MacKinnon once said in these types of stories, which is that four women's word could count towards one. So a woman is one quarter of a person when it comes to this kind of inquiry.
Well, but, you know, it's
I think her story, we need to hear
this.
A lot more about from. We need to hear from Mark Judge under oath. We need to hear from other people who might have been at the party. I do not think that all the questions about this story have been answered.
I agree. And I also think that we've
been hearing from Republicans for the last few days, despite the fact that he denies these allegations. We've also been hearing that what he's accused of is not that bad. And I know that's not the argument that you're making, but this is also behavior that was normalized for way too long. You can see it in Mark Judge's writing, too.
I would not approve of anybody diminishing or downplaying the seriousness of the accusation. I haven't heard that. If they did, it's wrong. But I would also point out that politics plays a role here in the way people respond to accusations. It isn't always the case that we say, yes, let's believe the women, or let's at least take it very seriously and investigate. I mean, I'm sorry to go back this far, but I can't help it. You know, when you look at how Juanita Broderick was regarded, or Kathleen Willey, or Paula Jones in the day, they were doubted. The aspersions were cast upon them by people on the left because it was inconvenient to have Bill Clinton be the one who was being fingered as an abuser.
Yeah,
and
you can't take
the politics out of it.
Actually, Mona,
I'm so glad that you brought that up.
I just want to jump in here, and I'm going to echo what you were about to say, Erin. Mona, I am very glad that you brought that up, because I actually think that that is absolutely one of the things that's at the heart of the matter. Like, when it comes to accusations of sexual harassment or sexual assault and the responses to it, in this country for, you know, 30 years now, we've seen how it is a Rorschach test for a person's personal politics here. You're absolutely mm-hmm. right. There were many people on the left who were wildly hypocritical about their views about Bill Clinton. So my question is, you know, so now, given that, how can we possibly move forward or deal with this moment regarding Judge Kavanaugh and Professor Blasey with any sort of confidence?
Speaking of somebody who, on Bill Clinton in particular, because I think actually you're right. And I think that there were a lot of people who went back and looked at in the 90s at how they reacted to that. And it's one of the reasons that you saw Democrats push out Al Franken effectively. Al Franken would have been there questioning Brett Kavanaugh these past weeks had Democrats not decided to push him to resign. And if that's not an example of neutral principles, I don't know what is. And so it is true. I have learned throughout the last few months that there will always be someone who says, no, not the person that I like, whether it's politics or whether it's someone that they know. Yeah. And despite all of the evidence. But I do think that this is a moment to try to figure out how can there be a neutral process in which we can actually find out what's true here.
Right. Mona, go ahead.
I believe in searching for the truth, of course. And I am somebody who I think should have a certain amount of benefit of the doubt and bona fides, because I've publicly criticized President Trump. I'm, you know, conservative, and I criticized Republicans and conservatives for tolerating his sexual abuse, not questioning it, and Roy Moore, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's hard to call out your own side, but it's very, very necessary if we're going to have any kind of serious civic hygiene in our society. And so I hope that we can all aspire to that. That much having been said, I have to say that conservatives are – now, some of them are going to be closed-minded and they won't believe any accusation against Kavanaugh. They'll think it's all made up. But others are – who are maybe not quite so rigid are going to look at this and say Dianne Feinstein's role in this is a little bit fishy. She had this letter. She knew about it in July. She held it for a long time and then released it at the very last minute. And people feel like, well, that's really looks like a late hit. She claims that she did not release it because Professor Ford was not ready to come forward. But the fact is, she announced the existence of the letter and the referral to the FBI before Professor Ford identified herself. So that doesn't add up. And frankly, it's adding to the sense that this is politicized already.
Yeah.
I don't actually think that that's an accurate characterization of what happened, because The Intercept first reported that there was a letter, and all she said that she received information under pressure from Senate Democrats who wanted to know what was in it. And only after Professor Ford came forward in The Washington Post were the actual contents of the letters published.
Right. Well,
the existence of it was made public by Senator Feinstein, which was enough to throw the entire nomination into turmoil.
So, we could, and maybe if we had an extra hour, should try and discern the exact chronology of the existence of this letter. But we have lots of callers who want to join us. I really need to get some of them in here. So let's quickly go to Karen, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air, Karen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I counseled rape victims for 24 years for the Detroit Police Department, and what I'm seeing here is the norm. Most women do not come forward, do not make police reports because of the shame and the doubts involved, and it changes the whole course of their life. So I understand why she just now came forward, because it was difficult for her to watch what was going on, knowing what she knew and knowing what she experienced, because you carry it with you for the rest of your life. I'm a survivor, so I know.
Karen, thank you so much for your call.
I'm not questioning the Professor Ford's actions. I'm questioning Senator Feinstein's. Professor Ford did actually send her information asking that she be kept confidential. But in any event, she did contact the committee back in the summer, not at the last minute.
Right. But I guess maybe Karen's responding to it's not Mona, you're right. You didn't say this, and Erin definitely hasn't said it either. But out there in the zeitgeist right now, there are a lot of people saying, well, why did she wait 36 years to come forward?
Yeah,
well,
no, that's perfectly understandable. If it's true, you can easily understand why people don't talk about these things. And you know, the fact that doesn't prove one way or the other whether she is a reliable witness.
I just want to add that you know, in the fall of 2017, where a lot of people felt empowered to tell their stories for the first time, there's been reporting that Professor Blasey Ford told people in her life, and she'd previously told her therapist, she had told her husband. So there are people that she told, but also as a 15-year-old, it is, and as our caller has said, there's so many reasons why somebody wouldn't talk about something like that happening,
right.
Among
Let's
others,
be clear,
because
though,
it was,
she was
an environment in which women were blamed for drinking.
Yeah, she was not a rape victim. Let's make that clear, though.
Well, I mean, she's alleging a fairly serious sexual assault. So we're going to take a lot more callers and keep exploring this when we come back. We're speaking with Mona Charon. She's senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a syndicated columnist at the National Review. Erin Carmone also joins us. She's senior correspondent at New York Magazine. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks. We got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about Judge Brett Kavanaugh, about Professor Christine Blasey Ford, about the allegations of sexual assault that she's brought against him, and the fact that if all goes as we've been told, they both may be testifying publicly and under oath about it on Monday. We're joined today by Mona Charon. She's senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's also a syndicated columnist at the National Review. And by Erin Carmone. She's a senior correspondent at New York Magazine. Mona and Erin, there's a question that I think we've sort of been skirting around. And let's just take it head on here. And Mona, let me just start with you. Because we spent a little bit of time before the break going over details about the nature of the allegations, the timing of the release of the allegations, and Professor Blasey making her identity public, et cetera, et cetera. But what I really want to get to is, I mean, Mona, what do you think about the idea that some people are saying, maybe a lot of people are saying, the very fact that these allegations supposedly happened when or the alleged acts supposedly happened when Judge Kavanaugh was 17 makes the whole issue moot, that it's not relevant to the service he might provide to the Supreme Court?
Look, it's a very tough issue. I can imagine – I think 17 is old enough to be morally responsible for your actions, whereas, you know, for example, 12 maybe wouldn't be. At the same time, everything depends upon how one Nobody is without sin. People do things that they later regret. Some people turn their whole lives around after they've done something they're ashamed of. So everything would rest on, if it were true that he did something terrible at the age of 17, what did he do afterwards? What did he do to make restitution, to apologize, to change his life? There are all kinds of stories of redemption. The problem is that this is black or white. He says it did not happen. And therefore, it's going to rest on whether we think he did or didn't do it. I can imagine a scenario in which he might have said, "Well, yes, we had a date, and there were mixed signals, and I thought she was consenting, and so on and so forth." But he's not saying that. He's just saying it didn't happen.
A blanket denial. Erin, I'm going to get your response here, but let's go to Bree, who's calling from Buffalo, New York, who has a thought about this. Bree, what do you think?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My thought is just that I don't think that it's a question of his character so much as whether or not he did it. And the fact that he might not remember that he did it because he was overly drunk or it was a party doesn't really matter. What matters is the effect that it had on Dr. Ford, and it had a significant impact on her life. So the question of character doesn't really come into play. It's just whether or not he did it. And he has been shown to be a heavy drinker, back in those days.
Bree, thank you so much for your call. Erin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I take Dr. Ford at her word that this is something that has caused significant trauma to her over the years, and I think that that's really important to take into account. And I agree with Mona. I mean, it were a hypothetical in which he might have done it. As the evidence could suggest, if there were a full investigation, it's sort of a hypothetical. But I found it really interesting that in the last few, because he says he didn't do it. But that said, I did find it interesting that in the last few days there were multiple people, including senators and some anonymous people from the White House, some conservative political commentators, certainly not all, saying who among us has not done this. And that's not the position that Mona's taking, but I do find it very disturbing. And I agree with you, Mona, that if somebody did make a youthful mistake, that they should be given an opportunity for counseling, for restitution, to make amends, but that is not a unilateral process, and that would have to involve the consent and the participation of the victim, and the restitution can't just happen in the perpetrator's own heads. And I would also add, that 17-year-olds all over the country are paying the price for crimes that they may or may not have committed, and that the criminal justice system is very merciless when it comes to certain people, not people who look like Brett Kavanaugh, generally young men of color who may or may not make mistakes that they end up paying for the rest of their lives. And I'm glad for Brett Kavanaugh that if this is true, that he was able to go on and pursue all of his dreams. But I think when we think about how we imagine a 17-year-old, how much of the benefit of the doubt do people who look like Brett Kavanaugh and run in his circles get compared to an average 17-year-old African-American teen?
We cannot conclude that this man is guilty because he's white or because he's upper
middle class. No, I was just answering the question about was he 17? How do we consider it? And I think any time that we're asking, should someone be responsible for 17, we're not for what they did when they were 17, we're not just thinking about one person. So I just think we need to examine our own biases as we move forward. And I completely agree. I do not know whether he did it. I would like there to be more evidence. I would like there to be a fair investigation.
Mona?
Absolutely. It needs to be investigated for everyone's sake, for our sake as a society, because we don't want to put someone on the Supreme Court who might have done something like this, and who, if he did it, is lying. So that would be a huge problem about his character. If he were guilty and he's fully denying it, then he's lying, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
Also, though, we have to keep in mind, try to think of it, like zoom up 30,000 feet. We don't know the truth. We don't know the truth. We have two diametrically opposed accounts. We'll hear more, I guess, when they testify, and hopefully it'll help us come to some sort of a decision. But we have to remember that in fairness, we cannot go into this with a bias against either one of them.
Mm. But, I mean, that gets us back to a point we were exploring earlier. Then why not give the process time with, an FBI or some third-party investigation to discern as close as we can what the truth actually is?
Well, so, I mean, I suppose that's possible, but it's been 36 years. It's really difficult to investigate a crime that's even 3 or 4 years old, mm-hmm. far less 36. It would be almost impossible, I think, to get at the truth. The only thing we have really is the accounts of the two people and perhaps this third fellow who she says was in the room.
Yeah,
it may be difficult to investigate it, but I don't think it's impossible. There are other people who she says were at the party that we haven't heard from yet. There's certainly other people who may come forward, as you say. I mean, I think that there is a question here about timing. We only have between now and Monday when these hearings have been scheduled. And I think we do need, if we are stepping back, we should step back and realize that the timing has been set by people who just want to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed before the midterms.
Well, and there are lots of people who don't want him to get confirmed before the midterms, just as many.
Right.
If not
but
more.
Again, if this is a question about fairly investigating it, as you say, why not fairly investigate it? What is the rush?
Well, you know what? I just want to switch gears here for a moment because, as I noted a little earlier this hour, today the New York Times posted an op-ed from Anita Hill. And it's really interesting. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. And in it, she reflects on her testimony that she gave in 1991 regarding her sexual harassment claims against then-Judge Clarence Thomas. And in her op-ed, she writes, "In 1991, the Senate Judiciary Committee had an opportunity to demonstrate its appreciation for both the seriousness of sexual harassment claims and the need for public confidence in the character of a nominee to the Supreme Court. It failed on both counts. But Professor Hill writes, there are ways to do better now." I just want to just kind of go in the time machine for here a second and play a clip of the many hours of testimony she gave from 1991. So here is Anita Hill at the Thomas hearings being questioned by Alabama Democrat Senator Howell Heflin, now the late Senator Heflin. He's talking to her about her testimony and questioning the reasons she may or may not have had to come forward.
"Do you have a militant attitude relative to the area of civil rights?"
"No, I don't have a militant attitude."
"Do you have a martyr complex?"
"No, I don't."
"Well, do you see that coming out of this that you can be a hero in the civil rights movement?"
"I do not have that kind of complex. I don't like all of the attention that I'm getting. I would not, even if I like the attention, I would not lie to get attention."
Anita Hill in 1991. Let's go to Kristen, who's calling from Goldsboro, Maine. Kristen, do you remember the Hill testimony, the Hill hearings?
"Yes, I'm old enough to remember that and the hell that poor woman went through. And then after she went through that, there were women that came forward saying he did the same thing to them, which was very sad. But watching what she was going through, how were they going to come forward? Also, you know, I'm in my 60s. Twice in my life, I've had men say to me, I don't know why women get so upset about rape. It's just sex. It's the Adam and Eve syndrome, where Eve is the sexual, they have to desire her, and she's got to put herself out like she's the bad one, and men have no control over themselves if they see a attractive woman or if they're drunk. Mm. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, Chris,
we don't hold them accountable. And women are always the bad person.
Kristen, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Somerset, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Elizabeth.
Yes, hi. See, I'm calling because as a sexual assault victim, I find it very disturbing that Dianne Feinstein held on to this information for months before when she had the opportunity to question Judge Kavanaugh, and she chose not to. I find it trivializes the whole process and makes it look political when those of us who actually have to live with this every day now suffer because she makes this a political issue for political gain. Makes me very angry.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for your call and for sharing that thought. Let's get one more call in here. Mackenzie is calling from Bethel, Maine. You're on the air, Mackenzie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As a victim of sexual abuse and a friend and a family member of, unfortunately, many women who have also experienced it, I really just am almost offended by the idea that a man needs to be accused multiple times to be considered, oh, well, I guess this is real, because that is absolutely not true. It's a false idea. I think it's really unfortunate that Dr. Ford and Kavanaugh are going to be alone in this courtroom, and it's just her word against his. That is not justice.
All right. Well, Mackenzie, thank you so much for your call. Mona Charon, would you like to respond to that?
Let me clarify that the fact that somebody has a single accuser does not mean, in the sort of existential sense, that he isn't guilty. I'm just saying, from the point of view of a neutral fact finder, when you have two people, one making an accusation and the other adamantly denying it, how do you draw a conclusion? You can say, well, women never lie, but that's not true. You can say, men are always guilty. Well, that's not true. And so how do you come to a decision? And either there has to be some other evidence, or there has to be something in the way, in the demeanor of the two witnesses, or there has to be some other information that we have to help us come to our best understanding of what happened. We are not clairvoyant. We weren't in the room. If there was a room, we just don't know. And so I'm not, it's just a matter of how do you make sense of these conflicting accounts?
Yeah. We've just got a couple of, just 2 or 3 minutes left. And Mona and Erin, I'm still struck by that tape that we played from Anita Hill testifying in 1991, because I remember it very clearly. I was in high school back then, and it transfixed me. It was one of those moments where, whether or not you believed her, a woman took the risk to speak out. And it makes me wonder, I think there's a lot beyond the obviously huge issue of who's going to sit on the Supreme Court. Beyond even that, there's a lot riding on this moment, because, Erin, I'm thinking about all the young people, women and men, who are going to be watching if indeed this testimony happens on Monday, and how our nation's political leaders handle it, given all the complications that both you and Mona have talked about this hour.
Meghna, what's so amazing is that so much has changed since 1991, and yet one thing that hasn't changed is the Republican side of the House Judiciary Committee is still 100% white men. At the time, there were only white men on both sides on the Senate Judiciary Committee that questioned her. And I have some serious criticisms with how Joe Biden, the Democratic chairman, handled those hearings by not calling other corroborating witnesses.
Yeah, he does not get a pass.
Yeah, I do not give him a pass. Yeah. And I think it's, if he chooses to run for president, more people will be holding him accountable for how he handled Professor Hill's allegations. But, that moment was traumatizing for a lot of people, because they put Anita Hill on trial. And there were lots of reasons that women turned out and voted in the 1992 elections and actually elected Bill Clinton and many more, although not enough, female senators, including Dianne Feinstein. But a big reason was that they were furious and they wanted to see representative government. Mm. They wanted to see not only a small portion of the population, the same old people who, in fact, are still sitting there today. And there's now been talk, there's some rumors and political reporting that Republicans may actually have somebody else question it, because there are Republican women in the Senate, but none of them are in a position to question Professor Ford.
We've got 30 seconds left here. And Mona, I want to give you the last thought and just add this one thing, that a couple of years ago, I spoke with Professor Hill directly, and she told me at that time that she didn't even consider her job in 1991 to change the Senators' minds. She said that wasn't her job. Her job was simply to tell her story. How do we reflect on that today?
Look, we have to keep in mind the possibility that these accusations are not true. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are railroading innocent men just for being men. And I'm all for holding people accountable, and I am all for the Me Too movement, but we also have to bear in mind the terrible consequences of rushing to judgment because of the bad behavior of some men.
Yeah. Well, Mona Charon, Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and syndicated columnist at the National Review, my deepest gratitude, Mona. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Erin Carmone, Senior Correspondent at New York Magazine. Erin, my gratitude to you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.